step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is the Past Lives podcast, episode 196, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Past Lives podcast is to investigate evidence that demonstrates survival of the human soul. We look at past life memories, near-death experiences, spirit communication, and other incredible phenomena. And please check out my new podcast. It's called the Alien UFO Podcast, and I'll be releasing new episodes every Monday, and you can find it on almost every podcast app. Now this is the free 1 hour version of the episode. The extended episode is 1 hour and 24 minutes. And to get access to the extra 24 minutes and to the other extended versions of the episodes, you can join the Past Lives Podcast Patreon campaign. When you sign up for $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. There is also a new $12.50 Patreon tier, where every week you can get the extended episodes of the Past Lives podcast and the Alien UFO podcast extended episodes. There are now 41 extended episodes for the $5 patrons. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or looking on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. Also, when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me and you are a patron, you will get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call which can be booked on my website. Or there's a Past Lives Podcast Facebook group, and if you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. The links are in the show notes, and you can find the show notes for this and every other episode on my website. My Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word, and on Twitter I am at Simon G. Bowne. And remember to subscribe and like and even leave a review if you feel like it, it'd be much appreciated. This week I'm talking to Sharon Rawlett about her book, Beyond Death, The Best Evidence for the Survival of Human Consciousness. Sharon is a writer and philosopher who studies extraordinary experiences and what they have to tell us about consciousness and the deeper nature of the world we live in. Her book, The Source and Significance of Coincidences, was published in 2019. In November 2021, she was named a runner-up in the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies essay contest for her essay, Beyond Death. Hi, Sharon. Thanks a lot for coming back to the podcast.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for inviting me back.
So I saw your book. It's called Beyond Death, The Best Evidence for the Survival of Human Consciousness. So how did you get the idea to do this?
Well, actually, this book came about, it only started about a year ago when I found out that the newly formed Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies here in the U.S. was advertising an essay contest for essays about the best evidence for the survival of human consciousness after death. And they were offering quite nice monetary prizes for it. And I thought, well, this is something I've got to do, you know, not just financially, but because I was like, wow, this is right smack in the middle of my interest area. I would love, this sort of gave me an excuse to take all of this material that I had compiled over the years, evidence about life after death, and to really put it all in one place, systematize it, analyze it, and and ultimately figure out, well, how much evidence does this really give us for life after death? So I started working on that essay less than a year ago and turned it in August. And the prizes were announced in November. And I actually won one of the runner-up prizes. The Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies has been very generous. They actually realized that they had so many excellent essays that were submitted that they increased the number of prizes that they offered. So they ended up awarding prizes to maybe, I think, 29 different researchers. So there's a huge wealth of information now about this topic that has just become available on their website a couple of months ago in November. So my essay was selected in the second tier of prizes. And so after that happened, I realized that besides just having this put out on the web, because it's available for free for anybody who wants to read it in PDF form on the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies website. But I realized that there were a lot of people who would prefer to have it in a hard copy form as a book. And so I had it formatted very nicely and got a great cover for it. And so actually published it as a book as well this past December. But it's exactly the same material that is available for free on the web too. So you can find it in either place. So it really, it came about because of this contest. It kind of gave me an excuse to spend a lot of time working on this. But I'm so glad that I did, because I'm really, as with all of my books, like I write them first and foremost for myself. Like I was so excited to get to synthesize all of this material, but I think it also makes a great compact distillation of the last 150 years of survival research that has been done.
So when you were putting this together, where did you get the information from? Because it looks like you've read tons of books.
And I have. That is my major occupation, really. I tell people that I'm a writer, but first and foremost, I'm a reader and a researcher. So I've been reading about this for over a decade, honestly. Every book that I can get my hands on that has anything to do with this topic. And what I do when I read the books is I notate them. So my husband is always telling me, stop writing in your book so much. But this is, I had a college professor actually who told me, she said, the most important thing that you will have in your textbooks when you graduate from college is the notes that you wrote into them. And I've definitely taken that to heart. So I notate everything that I read, and I keep a separate list as well of the important cases that I come across, because I'm always thinking about how the different cases fit together and what different evidential qualities they have. So for instance, in my book Beyond Death, one of the things that I lay out is I have this diagram that shows the various phenomena like apparitions or dreams of the deceased or poltergeist effects. And then I list the different evidential qualities that each of them has. So for instance, there are cases in all of these different categories where the phenomenon happens before the person who experiences it is aware that the person has died. So they don't know that this person has passed on. In a lot of cases, they don't even know that they were in danger of passing on. They didn't know they were sick or anything, but they have an apparition or a dream of this person who comes to them and maybe says goodbye or says how they died. And that's how they first learn about this. So that's one evidential quality. But then you have all of these other ones, like you have multiple people who will experience the same phenomenon, showing that, well, it's not just a hallucination had by a single individual. You've got multiple people who are seeing this apparition or who are having the same dream of the person. You have the quality of phenomena that occur to bystanders, which I define as people who are not emotionally invested in the survival of this particular person. It's just it's not somebody who knew them very well or maybe even at all during their life, but they have an after-death contact from them. So you can't say, well, that's just wishful thinking that created this, because they weren't wishing to hear from the person. Another one of the evidential qualities is a new information that is introduced by the apparition or the dream, by the after-death contact. So they will tell someone maybe how they died or some aspect of how they died that they didn't know before, or they'll tell them about something that happened during their life that they didn't know before and that they'll later be able to verify is true. And some other evidential qualities, goal-directed behavior, the apparition or the dream character or the poltergeist will be clearly trying to achieve a certain goal by this contact with the living person. There's something that they're trying to accomplish. And also the interactive nature of them. It's not just like a message that sort of could have come, maybe like a leftover message that was imprinted in the Akashic records or something. But there's actually interaction that happens between the personality of the person who's passed on and the living person. So I've come up with, you know, this list of all of these different evidential qualities that point to the objective reality of the continued existence of this person's personality after death. And then I've been slowly through the years gathering the different cases that show that this evidential quality applies to all of these different after-death phenomena. So I've been putting the puzzle pieces together for many years at this point.
And it's split into two parts. There's a part one is the third person evidence and second part is first person evidence. So what do you put in together with third person evidence?
So the third person evidence is phenomena where a living person is seeing something that provides evidence of somebody else's continued existence after death. So for instance, if you see an apparition of a deceased person, if you have a dream of someone who's passed on, poltergeist effects that you feel are related to somebody who's passed on. Some other lesser known third person phenomena include telephone calls from the dead. So this is actually quite a common phenomenon. I've come across it. I say in the essay that I've found it in not just the three books that have been written specifically on this topic, but at this point, it seems like every book that I read about after-death communication, there are more cases of people who have actually gotten phone calls from deceased loved ones. So I've found it now, I think, in 15 other books that are not specifically dedicated to this topic, but they'll just kind of offhandedly, somebody will mention, oh yeah, and after my aunt died, I got this phone call. You know, sometimes they happen in the middle of the night. I got this phone call in the middle of the night and my aunt just was talking to me on the phone and delivering this message. So it's kind of like an apparition, but it's auditory only. And it comes through a telephone. The telephone actually rings and then you have this conversation with the person. So those telephone calls from the dead, also mediumship. Whether that is mental mediumship, where a medium is delivering messages that they are getting from your deceased loved ones, or whether it's physical mediumship, where there's some kind of physical manifestation of their presence. And then one final category that I discuss is synchronicity or coincidence, because that's one of my specialties in research as well. The book that you had me on a couple of years ago to discuss was specifically about synchronicity and coincidence. And so I felt like I couldn't write a whole essay about evidence for life after death without including the evidence that comes from synchronicity and coincidence. So in Beyond Death, I specifically talk about synchronicities that not only seem to be from a deceased loved one, but that are particularly evidential and seem to provide evidence of a particular message that the deceased person wanted to get across, or provide evidence about specific aspects of their personality that are still continuing from the other side. So yeah, so those are the basic categories of the third person evidence.
And with the first person, it's near-death experiences and memories of past lives.
Yes. So first person, I mean, these are memories that people have of themselves having died and their consciousness continuing afterward. So their body is dead and they were still aware. And near-death experiences are the most common, the most well-known form of this, although they are... It actually now I think it's debatable about whether they're the most common or not. And let me explain why I'm saying that. So for a while, it's been known that the number of people in the general population who have had a near-death experience is somewhere between 4% and 15%. So different surveys show slightly different numbers, but still, there, you know, maybe around 10% of the general population has had a near-death experience. So that's an enormous number of people. For a long time, I think I would have said that that was the most common first-person experience of survival of death. But honestly, in the last 5 or 10 years, the number of people who have been coming forward to talk about their memories of past lives and the number of children who have memories of past lives has just become overwhelming. I don't know if you're, there've got to be some of your listeners who are part of some of the Facebook groups about this as well, but they're the ones that I'm a part of, in particular, the very science-based one, Signs of Reincarnation, has just known phenomenal growth over the last year or two. And it's just incredible to see the number of children who remember things about their previous lives, and sometimes adults as well. Although it's harder to keep that memory into adulthood because we forget over time. We forget most of the things that happened to us when we were young children. So it makes even more sense we would forget the things that happened to us before we were children. All that to say, I'm not convinced that the number of, or the percentage of people who have past life memories, at least when they're children, isn't even higher than in near-death experiences. But as people do more surveys of that, we'll get better numbers. So those two things. But then also, one thing that I thought was really important to put in this book is not just past life memories, but memories of the intermission period or the life between lives. Because one of the things that really bugged me a lot in my early years of doing survival research was the skeptical hypothesis that's called either super psi hypothesis or living agent psi hypothesis. And this is the idea that it might be that all of these phenomena that we experience that seem to be indicating the survival of our loved ones after death are really just like psychic tricks that our minds are playing on us. That living people have enough sort of unconscious psychic skills that we are able to create these simulations for ourselves of communicating with our loved ones. So unconsciously, we may be able to get enough psychic information that we're able to create for ourselves a hallucination or a very vivid dream of our loved one, and maybe even, you know, work some psychic information in there about things that we never learned in life about them, but we do that to make it very convincing and realistic to ourselves. But the idea here is that those people don't really go on. We're just comforting ourselves using this psychic information that we have developed. Now, this is, theoretically, it is a hypothesis that it's possible. There's nothing, or at least, you know, when I was starting out in the research, it seemed like there was nothing that directly contradicted this. It seemed like you could always explain the evidence as somehow being reducible to living agent psychic abilities, living agent psi. But that's a very, it would be a disheartening conclusion. And so this really bothered me. I wanted to know, like, is that really all that it is? Are we really just fooling ourselves? Or do our loved ones really still exist, and do they communicate with us? So that's one of the major questions that I have taken to my review of all of this literature. Every time I'm reading these cases, I'm thinking, okay, does this provide any evidence that we can use to deal with this living agent psi hypothesis? And the most important evidence that I have come across that really put that worry to bed for me was these intermission memories. These memories that some children and some adults have, not just of having lived a previous life, but after they die in that previous life, remembering the same sorts of things that near-death experiencers remember. So they remember, you know, coming out of their body, watching their body from above. They remember things that near-death experiencers would never get to remember. So they remember actually attending their funerals. Sometimes in a few cases, they have actually reported details about their burial they couldn't have known. It was some unexpected way that their body was treated at the time of burial. The researchers were able to verify later that that was in fact what had happened to the body of their previous personality. So they view things from the end of their previous life. And then they will have memories of interacting with other deceased people on the other side. Sometimes, for instance, children will remember having met relatives from their new family. So the family that the child is then going to be born into, while they were still on the other side, they met some people who were, say, going to be their grandfather or going to be their great-grandfather in their new life, but actually died before they were born. And then when they're born, they have these memories of having interacted with that family member, and they tell their family member about, you know, Grandpa Joe or something, and tell them some idiosyncratic things about Grandpa Joe that they couldn't have known otherwise. So there's some evidential qualities there as well. Another really fascinating thing that children remember from the life between lives is viewing their future families as well. So they will even talk about, in some cases, choosing their future families. So seeing their parents and deciding, yes, this is the person that I want to go be born to. But they can tell, you know, specific things that they saw their parents doing before their birth or around the time of their conception often. And then a lot of children, well, not a lot of children, some children who have intermission memories will actually remember something about actually entering their new body or entering the womb. And sometimes there will be specific details about something that happened during the pregnancy or what have you that matches what they were remembering. So for me, these evidential memories, these verifiable memories that children have, not just of a previous life, but of that time when there was no physical body associated with them whatsoever. Their previous body was dead. Their new body had not even been conceived yet. And yet they're reporting being conscious during that time, observing things during that time. And the clincher for me is they also, in some cases, remember communicating with people from that time between lives. So they remember, for instance, coming to someone in a dream during that time. And they remember some specific information that was exchanged. And then somebody, the person who was alive communicating with them, remembers that specific dream and that specific information. Or children remember in a couple, I guess I found three cases where children remember having appeared as an apparition, so a waking vision to somebody here on Earth during that intermission period, and a couple of cases where they didn't appear, but they seemed to have physical effects on the world, and so were remembered being poltergeists, basically, and people on Earth could verify that. So you have these reciprocal cases; they're remembered by both the living person and the person who was not in a physical body at that time.
Hello, listeners. This is Simon. Now, as some of you know, I have a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy, and I'm certified in past life regression therapy. And in the past few weeks, I've taken many clients through some amazing and healing past life regressions. And I conduct sessions over Zoom, and I've had clients from many countries around the world. Now, when you go through a past life regression, you will feel totally in control and remember everything. And also, I record the whole session and send you an MP3 afterwards. And this gives you space to relax and go with the flow, knowing that you can listen back later and analyse what you experienced if you need to. So if you ever wanted to explore your past lives in a single session or have an issue you want to work on, you can go to my website at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk and book a free 20-minute consultation. And at the moment, I'm offering a 25% discount to everyone that has signed up to the Patreon campaign. The link is in the show notes. So what do you make of this thing where children may have birthmarks or deformities that seem to be linked to a previous life?
Well, I think this is really one of the most intriguing aspects of past life memories because it really opens a whole new door to our understanding of the way that our mind interacts with our physical body. That I don't think, I mean, current medicine has some idea about that. We have the concept of the placebo effect, that our minds can influence the way that our bodies work to some extent. But these cases of past life memories or things that happen to someone in a past life, that happened to their body in a past life, having an effect on their body in a new life, I think just make even stronger this argument for a connection between the mind and the physical body. So I think what's happening is the mind of the person who died in the previous life, and often these birthmarks have to do with wounds that the previous personality received, and often wounds that they that actually caused their death. Not always, but that's usually where they came from. So you'll have a child who has a birthmark, say like a sort of a like a, looks like a scar kind of on the, say, the front of their chest. And then they'll have another scar on the back, on their back. And this will correspond to the a bullet wound that was had by their previous personality. So they also remember having had this life where they were shot in the chest. And when that previous personality is identified by researchers or perhaps by family members, but when that previous personality is identified, they can verify, yes, indeed, this person was shot in the chest. And in some cases, they even have medical records of, or, you know, records of the autopsy that was done on the body that show exactly where these wounds were. And they correspond uncannily to the scars that these children are born with afterward. So how does that transfer happen? Well, there isn't any physical connection between the previous body and the current body. The only connection is the mind. And so I think we have to conclude that somehow the mind carries an image of that previous body. It's carrying some representation of the body that they previously were inhabiting. And then when they incarnate into a new body, somehow that mental representation has an effect on the way this new body develops. And we don't know the exact processes yet, but somehow it's imprinting on that new body.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? And it's one of the things I love about all this stuff is it's still such a mystery. And even magical, you might say, that these things, it's like Harry Potter actually happening in the real world.
Right. And in such unexpected ways. Like, I feel like even J.K. Rowling wouldn't come up with this strange thing about, you know, previous scars showing up on a new body. Like, this is just, I don't think anybody that, you know, Ian Stevenson is the big name in this field. I don't think that when he went and started to research, he would have thought, oh, I need to, you know, look for like scars from a previous life. I think this is very unexpected, even for people who really know about how psychic stuff works. This is really odd. But that is what is so fascinating and what is so engrossing about this field of study, because when you're willing to look at the really odd stuff, the stuff that really doesn't fit our current theories, whether they're mainstream scientific theories or they're, you know, mainstream parapsychological theories, the outlying stuff, that's where you really stand to learn new material about the way that our reality functions. And so I think it's so important to always keep those really strange things in mind and not just to, you know, throw them out. Because I think mainstream science in particular, it has a tendency to just explain away anything that doesn't fit into the current scientific paradigm or the currently fashionable theory. And, you know, whether it's psychology or philosophy or neuroscience, we just want to ignore the data that doesn't fit. But that's how science progresses, is by really focusing on that data that doesn't fit. And that's the stuff that's the most exciting to me.
And so can we go into some of these cases that are in the book? Because, you know, I love it when I read these things. And the first one I wanted to talk about was Captain Wheatcroft, who was in India, and this was 1857.
Yes. So this is one of these apparitions that happens before the person knows that the person has died. So in this case, you have a woman whose husband was away. So she's an English woman. Her husband is away in India. And, you know, she could probably presume that he was fighting at various points, but I mean, she didn't have any particular reason to think that he had been injured or killed. But one night, she has this vision of him where he's, I don't remember exactly what she said, but it was like he seemed like he was in pain, or, you know, he was sort of bent over a little bit when he came to her. And she immediately, once he had, you know, kind of come to her and he had disappeared, she was like, I think he died. That was her immediate conclusion from it. So it was sometime later. It was at least a couple of weeks later, maybe a month or so later, she finally got word from India that her husband had indeed been killed. But she was told that he was killed the day after she saw the apparition. And when she heard that, she was like, that doesn't seem right. She's like, I'm convinced that he died the day before, when, like, before I saw that vision of him. And there was actually some corroboration from another woman had a vision of him. She was a friend of Captain Wheatcroft's lawyer, I think it was. So she wasn't a close acquaintance by any means, but she may have been a professional medium. So I mean, she had skills and often, you know, would see deceased people. So she had also had a vision of him, or an apparition of him, on the same night that the wife did. Very similar, where he seemed to be in pain and kind of bent over. And so she too said, you know, I had the vision on this night. So we really think he died the day before, that they're officially saying that. And so later an investigation was done, and it turned out that in fact he did die the previous day. They had reported the date wrong originally, and they had to change the official records about when he passed away. So there you've got this apparition that is providing not only the information that he's died, but precise enough information about when it happened to cause them to double check the official record of his death.
And multiple people as well. So you couldn't say it was just this woman having a hallucination.
Right. Exactly. There's something more objective going on here.
And there was a great case. I think it was in Erlander Haraldsson said, a young man named, is it Gisli Frimundsson? One night he woke up to see an elderly man from the district standing in the middle of the floor. That it was later he got word that this man had died.
Right. So it was somebody that he sort of knew about. He wasn't, you know, great friends with him, but he just knew that he lived in that area. He hadn't known that he died, so he found out, I think, the next day that he had, in fact, died. But the funny thing was, when he went and talked to the man's widow, she said that she had actually had a dream of her husband that same night, I think, that he had the apparition. And in the dream, he had told his wife, I went to wherever the place was that the guy had the apparition of him. I went to that town, he said, but nobody there was aware of me except Gisli. So she had been told who he was appearing to, or who was the only person who was able to see him in the other place, which is such an interesting confirmation of his experience, and also points to one of the things that people have wondered about apparitions is, why don't more people see them? Or why, if an apparition appears in a room and there are multiple people there, why will only some of the people see the apparition and some people don't? Because, you know, you might have four people in a room and two of them will see an apparition of the deceased person and two of them won't see anything. And this particular case is, you actually have the deceased person communicating to his widow and saying, you know, I was trying to appear to these people, but only this person was able to be aware of me. Not a simple process.
And also, you talk about people who are not near death, but have out-of-body experiences in which other people see them at another location.
Yes. And I think this is also one of those really important pieces of evidence against the living agent psi hypothesis. So and particularly it's a piece of evidence against this idea that apparitions are just wishful thinking or a projection from the mind of the person who's seeing the apparition. Because we have a lot of different cases, and the ones you're talking about are like living people, they're not even close to death. And some of the, one of the cases that I have in Beyond Death, this guy, he's actually, he's a parapsychological researcher. He's just hanging out at a party, and he's a little bit bored at the party, and he suddenly realizes that he's kind of like in two places at once. Like he knows that his body is still at the party, but then he also is at his other friend's house and is able to carry on a conversation with her in this remote location. So yeah, this is what we would normally call an out of body experience. His consciousness is somewhere other than his body is, and he's able to interact with someone at that remote location. So he's having this conversation with his friend in this other place, and he was actually able to make some notes about what he had talked to her about. Like this was an extended conversation. Later, he went and spoke to her, and she remembered having the same conversation, discussing the same topics there. And I think it was also on this occasion that one of her pets actually was reacting to his presence too. So it wasn't just in her mind that she was having this conversation with him, but her like dog was growling at him or something, at this, his presence there in the room. So why I think this is important is in this case where you have a living person who is an apparition at another location, because she did, she not only had a conversation with him, but she did see him visually. So it was a visual apparition of him, this living person. You have this living person who's able to appear in this way and who has a conscious memory of being at that place and interacting with someone at that place. And that itself shows that these apparitions are not simply projections from our mind, that they are indicative of the presence of someone else's consciousness there, that there's an inside to the apparitions. Somebody's experiencing being that apparition. So we have a lot of different cases of living people who have these out-of-body experiences, and they're corroborated by somebody who experienced their apparition. We also have cases where they're near-death experiencers. So you have people who are on their deathbed, and they will have the experience of, a lot of times they'll say it's a dream, like they'll go to sleep, they'll have a dream of having been at a remote location. But the person that they visited at the remote location actually saw them appear to them. And they actually, in some cases, had a conversation with them and so forth. So we have the same phenomenon. We have the same apparition appearing and interacting as in the case of the apparition of a deceased person. But here we have somebody able to say, well, yeah, that was me. I was talking to you. I remember doing that. And that makes it much more plausible that in the case of apparitions of the deceased, there is a consciousness behind them. It's not just a simulation. There really is someone interacting with you. Your deceased loved one is really interacting with you. And in fact, there was a study done, this was back in the 50s. Parapsychologist Hornell Hart and a few of his colleagues did a systematic comparison between apparitions of living out-of-body experiencers and apparitions of the deceased. And they compared them on several different levels as to their characteristics. And they concluded that the characteristics were so similar between these two phenomena, that in fact it was a single phenomenon, that apparitions are simply a way that we, that our consciousness can communicate with other people. And it doesn't matter whether it's a consciousness that's associated with a living body or it's a consciousness that is no longer associated with a living body, they still manifest in the same way.
You wonder why, when all this stuff's going on around us so much, why it's even denied anymore, that why the skeptics don't kind of just give up.
It's a good question. You know, it's, I think a lot of it is it's a cultural phenomenon. As a wider culture, well, we're not a single culture. That's the thing, is there certainly is a subset of our culture, this whole community of people who listen to your podcast, this whole community of people who write, you know, books about their experiences, this community that I think is ultimately founded on people who have had direct experience of these phenomena. When you've had it happen to you, it's very hard to dismiss it and say that's not real. But for people who haven't had it happen to them, it's much easier to explain it away in some other way and to say, well, they're saying that they saw this, or they say that it was confirmed by this other person, but they must just be mistaken because things like that can't happen. It's impossible. And I think even for myself, I felt that way early on in my research. Like I was very skeptical about the things I was reading. I was like, would it really, like, maybe they're stretching the truth. Like, could this really happen? But once it happened to me, once I experienced something that current science had said was impossible, I said, okay, now I get it. And I was much more willing to take other people's experiences at face value, or at least want to investigate them further, because I realized, no, strange things really do happen. But for people who haven't had that experience, I guess, you know, it's easier to put it out of their mind. It's easier just to say that people are crazy or misguided, or, you know, misinterpreting things.
So if we get back to the book, one of the things that's always fascinated me is this phone calls thing. And there's a case you have by Dr. John Lerner about Mary Esther's phone calls.
Yes. Yeah, this is one of the coolest cases that I've run across, because there are so many different people involved, at least three different people. So in this case, a woman had just passed away in the hospital, Mary Esther, and the nurses that had been in charge of her were trying to get a hold of her son to tell him that she had passed on. And I guess they were having trouble getting through to him. So Mary Esther's doctor, John Lerma, and he's the one who's written the account of this story, he was going to the nurses' station to kind of see if they had had any success at contacting the son. And while he was at the nurse's station asking them about this, the phone rang. The nurse's phone rang, and one of the nurses picked it up, and she just kind of got this really strange look on her face. And she told them afterward that when she had picked up the phone, I'm trying to remember what the exact words were. Hold on, let me look it up, because this is important to say exactly what she said. I've got it right here. So I was trying to figure out whether she had, on the phone, she identified herself as Mary Esther. She didn't say her name on the phone, but the nurse's phone had a caller ID that said that the call was coming from Mary Esther's room. And all that the voice on the phone said was, "Tell my son I'm okay." Okay. So the voice says, tell my son I'm okay. And the caller ID says this is coming from Mary Esther's room. All right. So the nurse is freaked out about this. So she actually passes the phone to Dr. Lerma. He holds it up to his ear and he hears the same phrase, tell my son I'm okay. And he said it was kind of staticky, but he could clearly hear this message. So after that, they kind of all rush into her room to see like, who's there? Like somebody's pulling a prank on us from her bedroom, but there's nobody in her hospital room except her corpse at this point. So a little while later, Mary Esther's son arrives at the hospital. And I guess they had succeeded in contacting him and that's why he was there. But when he got to the hospital, he told them that before he had been contacted by them, before they had finally gotten through to him, he had gotten a phone call from a voice that sounded like his mom, Mary Esther. And she said, I'm okay. I love you. Don't worry about me. So he didn't even know that she had passed away at that point, but she called him and she called the nurse's station with that same message, trying to let her son know that she was okay. So this is one of the cases, like a bystander case, because not only does it come to the person who, you know, wants to be or would benefit from the message themselves, but it also provides extra evidence because it's coming to these people that aren't related to her at all.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So if we can move on then, because there's so much to talk about. In part two, you go into the first person evidence. So if we could talk about near-death experiences. And you quote from a book called The Self Does Not Die. Can you tell us about that book?
So this is an excellent book that was just written in the last 10 years, maybe in the last 5 years, compiled by three different NDE experts. And they were specifically interested in near-death experience cases that have objectively verifiable aspects to them. So kind of like the kind of research that I've done overall for after-death research, they specifically were trying to collect these evidential cases for near-death experiences. And in that book, they have the chapters arranged by what kind of objective evidence each of the cases provides. So it's a really excellent resource for anybody who wants to know specifically about cases where near-death experiencers perceive things from outside of their body that that they shouldn't have been able to perceive otherwise, and then it was verified by someone else. The best cases of that sort are collected there, and it's definitely worth checking out.
And another case you talk about is the Pamela Reynolds case. And I find that really fascinating when I heard about it a few years ago and I really read up on it. And what you say stood out for you is the thing about Hotel California and how they shocked her twice while trying to restart her heart.
Yeah. So one of the skeptical explanations for these perceptions during near-death experiences that is often given is that, well, the person wasn't really dead when they experienced this stuff. Like they still had some, you know, minor brain function. And so they were somehow able to perceive stuff going on in their environment. Well, the Pamela Reynolds case gives us very strong evidence that that is not a good explanation for what is going on, at least in her case. So she went through a surgery where I think to correct a an aneurysm in her brain. They actually had to drain all of the blood from her head, and they cooled her body way down so that they could perform this operation safely. And the entire time they're monitoring her brain function to make sure that her brain is not operating while they're doing this procedure. So it was very carefully monitored. And near the end of this procedure, where not only is she totally anesthetized, but her body is severely hypothermic. Her heart isn't beating. She is not breathing. The blood has been drained from her head. During this part of the procedure, she perceived that the operating room staff were listening to the song Hotel California while they were operating, which they confirmed afterward. And that when they went to restart her heart, they actually had to shock her twice, which is not something that could be easily predicted because the number of shocks that are required to get the heart going again, it varies. In different cases, but she was able to say, no, it was precisely two times, which can be verified in the medical records. So this is just one of those cases where we have extensive medical records that show exactly what the state of her body was at that time, and that she could not have had the brain function or the ability to perceive these things in her environment.
And also she had those kind of earbuds, didn't she, with the clicks that were quite loud.
Yeah, so that too. She had the earbuds that were playing these very loud clicks throughout the entire procedure. Because when they are monitoring the brain function, one of the ways that they do that is they play these very loud noises into the ears. So this is like the level of like a standing next to a train that's going by. So they're playing this very loud noise into the ears, in a clicking rhythm, so that they can then look at the brain function. And if they see spikes that go along with these clicks, then they know that the brain is actually operating. It's actually perceiving the sound. So they can, this is part of the monitoring process. So they can see, monitoring her brain waves, that her ears are not, or her brain is not receiving those signals from her ears. So there's no way that she could, with that sound blasting in her ears, there's no way she could have hurt Hotel California. But even if she could have, it would have shown up, the clicks at least would have shown up on her brain waves, and they did not. Hearing with something besides her ears.
I think it's a great case, and it's that thing, because the medical records there and the timing and when the things occurred, there's no way she could have created new memories the way she did because her brain wasn't working.
No. it had none of the things that it needed in order to be functioning. And they confirmed that it was not functioning because they were monitoring it at the time. Yeah.
And there's a statistics you quote in the book from Janice Holden. She reviewed 93 reports of physical events observed during the experiences, and that 86 were fully accurate and 6 contained some error, and only 1 was completely wrong. And it's just amazing, you know, how such a high percentage of what she reviewed showed to be correct. And it just reminds me of a report I read on a science website recently. Somebody wrote something about near-death experiences, and they wrote on there that there has not been one case of a near-death experience accurately reporting something.
Well, I guess they didn't read the literature before they wrote that, yeah. Which unfortunately is rather common. I think it's really funny when people write things like, there has never been a case like this. I don't write things like that because I'm like, well, there could always be a case that I don't know about. And to have people who clearly have not read the literature about near-death experience that are saying there has been no cases. It's very, very poor science and very poor reporting, unfortunately.
It's been great talking to you. The book's called Beyond Death, The Best Evidence for the Survival of Human Consciousness. And I really enjoyed reading it. Do you have plans for any more books?
I've got some things in the works. So yeah, stay tuned. I'm not ready to unveil them yet, but yeah, I'll say this, working on one sort of more practical book about sort of how to integrate these kinds of experiences when they happen to you or to your children, and one more theoretical book about kind of looking at the nature of reality in the light of all of this evidence. So.
Great. Well, you'll have to contact me so you can come back on the podcast.
Yeah, I certainly will.
Thanks again for coming on, and it's been great talking to you.
Thank you so much, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
And that was an interview with Sharon Rowlett about her book, Beyond Death, The Best Evidence for the Survival of Human Consciousness. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. And this is the free 1 hour version of the episode. The extended episode is 1 hour and 24 minutes. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week and the back catalogue of extended episodes. If you pay $12.50 a month, you'll have access to the Alien UFO podcast extended episodes as well. Also, if you're a patron, you get a 25% discount when you book a past life regression session with me. And please do check out my new podcast. It's called the Alien UFO podcast, and you can find it on almost every podcast app. And if you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.